Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. Today, we welcome Lexi with Stop Surrogacy Now UK. As some of you may know, Stop Surrogacy Now is a global campaign that brings together a worldwide, ethnically, religiously, and culturally diverse group of people opposed to the exploitation of women and the human trafficking of children through surrogacy. You can find more and join this global campaign at stopsurrogacynow.com. Stop Surrogacy Now UK was formed by a group of women who were and still are concerned about the proposals in the UK Law Commission put forward in its 2019 consultation to reform UK law. Lexi is one of those women, and she discovered about surrogacy through a parenting forum. After forming alliances with other concerned women, they launched this grassroots organization to challenge surrogacy law reform currently being proposed in the UK. Stop Surrogacy Now UK aims to raise awareness of the truth of surrogacy and challenge the erosion of language through media and raise up the voices of women and children heard when it comes to the laws that concern them. Lexi, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for taking the time today to chat with me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. So, do you mind if we go back a few years to when you first found out about the surrogacy industry and the laws surrounding this issue and what you kind of like initially were thinking and how you came to know about this issue and became so passionate about it?
Firstly, I think I have to begin with a thank you to Venus Rising, because there's so much that I've learned about surrogacy and the exploitation of women through the podcast that you guys have been doing there. So yes, I began to understand really what the issues were from a parenting forum that was discussing the law reform. And I was sort of interested in what this meant. I didn't have any sort of previous experience or even sort of thoughts about it, to be honest with you. But when I read the proposals that were through the public consultation, I realized that actually some of this was really quite concerning, and something needed to be done.
What was so concerning about it to you? What initially, or what was the first thing that you're like, oh, this doesn't seem quite right?
I think what has been called one of the key proposals is that they want to follow essentially the commercial model that comes out of America, out of the States. So I understand that you have a pre-birth order in a lot of these arrangements. And, you know, this is obviously widespread across the different states of America. And that would essentially be what they would be following here. They want for parental rights for the commissioning parents to begin at birth. And this would be quite a drastic shift from what has been in place under law and what we currently have.
Okay. Yeah. And here in the United States, it really does vary a little bit state to state. Like, we don't have one national kind of view on this, although other states' laws are changing all the time. So it does depend on what state the surrogate mother lives in and the commissioning parents where they're from as well. At the time when you were kind of figuring this out, were you aware of the global Stop Surrogacy Now movement?
Not at all. So, I mean, really, this is what introduced me. So when I was looking at the proposals and what was going to be changing, I learned about what the current law was, how that came about, where we sort of sat within like other parts of Europe. So, you know, obviously that this is widely, you know, banned from other European countries. And I also looked at, you know, what other countries were doing, such as Australia, New Zealand, India, Thailand. And I looked at it from like the global perspective, but obviously was looking at essentially what the law was, what the law proposals were, and then what was going to be changing. Because I wanted to understand it in a context of other countries as well. And it's been since, you know, I discovered all of this that I've really gone into it and started a campaign against the law reform.
Gotcha. So what are the laws as they stand now in the United Kingdom? Can you go into more detail? You talked a little bit about the parentage, but yeah, really go as specific as you'd like.
it's really quite interesting. So at the moment, you know, you could have a surrogacy arrangement, and it could, you know, generally it would be through an agency, although that's becoming less common. People are sort of doing it independently, but there would definitely be the mother, obviously the birth mother would retain parental rights, and she would sign this over in a parental order, which would go before a judge. And, you know, you would have lawyers and you would have that kind of situation, but she would be able to keep her parental rights if she wanted to, if there was a change of heart, essentially. But what this proposal would be to turn that around and to flip that around. So the commissioning parents would have parental rights at birth, and then the mother would have to make a claim, sort of like petition against that within 5 weeks of birth in Scotland and within 6 weeks of birth in England. Right. So we're looking at proposals changing in Scotland and England, and then potentially it would also, I think, you know, Ireland and Wales might follow the same sort of path. But this would be quite a key change, and obviously considering, so I was in this parental forum, you know, I was a new mother, I was thinking, you know, I wasn't really in any fit state 6 weeks post-birth. You know, I had an easy birth to sort of be making any life-changing decisions. And I think, you know, obviously somebody who's entertaining surrogacy or engaging in surrogacy and they're essentially giving the baby away, that could very much be how you feel during the pregnancy, and then something could change obviously after the birth. And I've watched the documentaries that have been produced by Jennifer Lull, and, you know, listened to the podcast, and I just think it's a really, it's very much thinking how you're going to feel and then not really having any opportunity to change your mind. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite big on consent and having, you know, freely given consent. And then I think you can only really have that as long as you can withdraw consent. And I think that's quite an important part of UK law. And obviously that would apply to surrogacy as well.
Yeah. And you make a big point here just briefly about consent. Like this child too is also not given its consent, and it might have different parents genetically than its birth mother. And then if there are, you know, changes of mind or attitude during this whole process, it can be quite confusing for this new little one that just came into the world. But you mentioned that a lot of that more people are going towards like doing this independently without like an industry or organization. Can you unwrap what you meant a little bit there?
There are no statistics on that, but certainly from sort of like media representation, it's almost easier for people to do it without an agency involved. So I think there are some people who obviously would look to go to an agency for guidance, advice, you know, going through the legal process. You know, obviously they don't offer legal advice as such, but they will give like a mediation. There will be, it's not a contract because the contract isn't enforceable, but they kind of call it a contract or an agreement. And it's essentially to say like, this is how long we will try to get pregnant for. This is what we would do if, you know, there would be a situation where it was a life or death situation with the mother and the child. Like they go through all of those scenarios, and whilst I don't support it, you know, I don't support agencies making money from the services, from reproductive services of women, essentially. I think that if you are going to do it, that it would be better to do it within a sort of framework, a regulatory framework. And for example, when you're using obviously sort of traditional surrogacy and you're using your own egg to have a child for somebody else, then you don't need a clinic involved. You know, it's kind of cheaper. It's certainly more favorable for, say, same-sex male couples who, you know, they can provide the sperm, but they need, you know, the woman and her body and her egg. Mm-hmm. And I was going to make another point about the parental order, because that's something in the UK where we're talking about the parents, the commissioning parents. So in the UK, you do have to have a genetic relationship with one of the commissioning parents, so that you wouldn't be able to get a parental order if you didn't have that. You would need to go through adoption. So obviously in terms of, you know, whether they're same-sex male couples or a heterosexual couple, if, for example, the woman couldn't use her eggs and they were using a traditional surrogacy, they were using a woman and her egg as well, the relationship would be with the father. So that is, and that does remain a requirement currently. It's possible that may change when we actually get to the bill, because obviously this is just in draft process. So we've had the consultation that lobbied for reform, And then we have the public consultation. And then everything since then has been delayed because of COVID. It's believed to be because of COVID, but things are moving along behind the scenes and we await news as to see basically what the bill is actually going to say.
Wow. And how does this affect or change? So I assume that the birth certificates of these children would have the birth mother on it, and then that would change after. Is that currently how it stands? Or
that is currently how it stands. Yes. So it's my understanding is it's similar to adoption in that you have an original birth certificate, and then with the parental order, you basically get a new birth certificate with possibly a new name of the child, but certainly the commissioning parents registered. And we don't have it here currently where you might put, for example, the genetic relationship that the child has with the people who gave the gametes, you know, essentially like a sperm donor or egg donor or whatever. But I think there's an argument there for that to be considered as well. But that isn't part of the proposals. It's very much the proposals were made as a, we're not looking to repeal it. We're only looking to reform it. And for the lobbying process that led up to the public consultation, there were, it wasn't like a broad spectrum of groups involved. It was quite limited, I think, in the scope in terms of, you know, who they spoke to. They didn't speak to women's groups, for example. They spoke to Stonewall, who I think you may have heard of. They're considered a controversial lobby group in the UK. They've been spoken about in the papers quite a lot recently, and they were involved in the actual drafting of the public consultation. So it was actually far over 500 pages. It was very dense. It was very difficult to complete. It certainly wasn't made sort of accessible. And, you know, it was, there are, we've looked at the proposal and there, you can sort of tell by the questions that they're asked. It was very difficult and complex. For sort of like the general public to understand, you'd have to read and really quite a, look at a lot of the detail of what they were saying there to understand it.
Are there any other regulations that are up for change as well? Like from what I understand in the UK, surrogacy is altruistic only, meaning that a woman cannot gain monetarily from this arrangement, but her services can, you know, pregnancy related expenses are paid for in that. Do you anticipate that changing? Is that still the same, or
that still would stay the same? However, I think the terminology of what is altruistic is possibly misunderstood. In that, you know, when you look at the expenses and what can be included in what can be considered expenses, is actually quite broad. So, for example, you could have treats for your kids because they haven't, you know, their mother is busy being pregnant, you know, childcare. Mm-hmm. You can have a portion of your electricity bill, your gas bill. You know, if you want to have a hot bath, that can be considered part of it. Your grocery bill, you can have. So I think the holidays is a bit of a question because some surrogate mothers say that we should, you know, have a holiday at the end of it. But, you know, then is that almost like a gift? Or a payment in kind, you know, it's not maybe like cold, hard cash to book flights, but it's sort of like, you know, a benefit. And I wouldn't say, you know, women who are pregnant, you know, just pregnant and receiving care on the National Health Service, they certainly don't get a holiday on the National Health Service at the end of it, you know, at the end of the pregnancy. So I think there's the idea that it is altruistic. And I'm certain that, you know, agencies and women who have done this would argue that it is. But I would say that you have to look at the expenses. There was a really interesting piece of research that was done by the University of Kent around this, around the, you know, the whole process of surrogacy, but certainly to do with the expenses and whether they wanted it to remain altruistic. And it was in the lead up to the public consultation. And absolutely, those involved in surrogacy, I think there were 177, I think that's right, people involved, including the partners of the women who are surrogate mothers. And I think they all pretty much said that it was, yes, they do want it to remain altruistic.
Wow.
Okay. But then the costs involved, it's sort of like, you know, there was an average of I think 15,000 to 20,000, but then 30% I think got paid between 20,000 and 30,000, and then there was a smaller percentage that paid more than that, and there has been a case, for example, of up to 60,000. being reported in the media. So it's kind of like, you know, how altruistic is it when you have something, you know, a lot of your household bills taken care of for a year, or if you get a holiday at the end, you know, are gifts, do gifts get included? You know, it's quite, I think how it's labeled. Yeah, it's the language. And it's sort of like, you know, I've heard people say, oh, we don't know how to compensate surrogate mothers. And it's like, well, if it's compensation, you know, we talk about a baby being a gift, it's the greatest generous gift, and compensation is essentially usually for damages, you know, like legally, in legal terms. And I think it's a bit of a bugbear of mine. It's something that I notice a lot when we talk about, so I always say surrogate mothers and I always say commissioning parents. You know, obviously in surrogacy circles, they would say intended parents and surrogates. And then we have terms like tummy mummy and, oh, I'm just an oven, you know, I'm just keeping the bun in the oven, I'm just, you know, growing the baby. The baby doesn't belong to me, it's not my baby. And also extreme babysitter, that's one that I've heard more recently, and it's sort of like I'm just babysitting. So yeah, I think it's like the language around it, particularly in the media as well. So you notice this, it's almost like once you notice it, you can't stop noticing it, and you sort of see it all the time.
Yeah.
And I think the model or the idea that actually UK surrogacy is altruistic is a little bit misleading. And I think people need to look at the details.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of fed into my next question I was going to talk to you about. The language used, that just seems kind of like it's erasing mothers and women. You know, like you said, it's, we preferred to use, you know, surrogate mother, but now they've started talking it, you know, yeah, a bun in the oven, or the babysitter, or just the carrier, or the womb. I saw an article the other day, someone had posted on social media, it was two men who used a surrogate to have a baby, and it said, two men, a womb makes a baby. So they completely erased, you know, the idea.
It's really interesting. And you keep seeing it. And I think the thing is that, so one of the things that I have, I mean, the whole thing obviously fascinates me, but one of the things is sort of when you have, particularly when you have gestational surrogacy, and you say it's, you know, I'm not genetically related to the baby, as if, I don't know, I kind of consider it as if like your womb is like a cupboard or a drawer, and you've just kind of put a baby in there, and that your bones don't leach calcium to make the bones of the child, and that your blood and your diet and, you know, all of the things that essentially make a child, it's not some separate entity to you. You may not have the, you know, the DNA material and the genetic material that created the child, but obviously we share cells. You know, I think it's called mitochondrial DNA, and then kind of like chimerism, like mini chimerism, where we sort of like swap cells, and it stays in your body. It stays in, you know, my child, you know, his DNA is in me and in him. But not just because of the fact that I used my egg to make him, but, you know, that he was inside my body. And, you know, then you have the breast milk that's obviously for that child. And I think the whole language around it is very much used as a separation, and it's almost like, well, you know, you had the child inside your body, but then when it's outside of your body, you have no rights, you have no interest in this child, you know, the child goes to effectively strangers. And, you know, even, you know, the baby doesn't know that its DNA is from this guy and the egg came from this woman or whatever. Like, you know, the baby only knows his or her or their mother.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know anything else.
Early on, right? Like in development, we know that babies respond to the maternal
heartbeat. They know your heartbeat. You know, the only person who knows my heartbeat from the inside is my child. And, you know, a lot of there is definitely a trend, I think possibly more so in the US, but for surrogate mothers to have already been mothers. And I think when you have, you know, children already, I think it's quite strange how they say, well, this one isn't mine. Mm-hmm. This one doesn't belong to me. And I think, well, how is it different from the children that you already had and that you've already given birth to?
I also think about the children of the surrogate mother too. Like oftentimes they're younger, right? This isn't someone who has like teenagers and then is deciding to be a surrogate, but how they feel about that. And if we're, what kind of, baby process, like, my mom had this baby, but this one she gave away, but she kept, like, how are they processing this? And, you know, I just kind of think about that and it makes me wonder.
I've been thinking about that very same thing. And actually, I discovered fairly recently that there's a young woman in the UK. She calls herself the traveling surrogate. So she essentially is. So I think her story is quite interesting. So her mother was a surrogate mother and she had 6 pregnancies in 10 years that were all her own egg. So obviously all her genetic material, and would be a half sibling of this young woman. And this young woman has followed in her mother's footsteps and she's had a baby using, again, her own egg to have a child for these commissioning parents. And her reasoning for this, or the reason essentially why she did this, was to have the maternity leave. So she then, she was obviously working and would be able to take a year off work to travel and, you know, get paid. You know, you basically have a statutory maternity pay in the UK. We also have the NHS, obviously, so the National Health Service, where we have free maternity care and, you know, going into labour, we don't have to pay any charges. You know, it's all free and provided by taxpayers. And yeah, I was looking at her videos on YouTube and sort of hearing about her story. And I was thinking, well, she obviously had her mother do this. And she was talking about how that's how they got to go on holiday. You know, they got a holiday at the end of the pregnancy. She used to listen to the baby inside her mother's stomach and, you know, hear the and see the kicks and everything. And she also doesn't want children of her own. So I was wondering how that affected her growing up. So she was 5 when her mother started doing this. And yeah, I've thought about that. And also like the effect on girls and the effect on boys, like if girls see their mothers using their bodies to sort of be useful or helpful to a, you know, a couple who can't have children, whether that be a heterosexual couple or a gay couple. And it's almost like they're providing a service, but is it almost like a daughter would see, oh, well, that's what women do. That's what, mm-hmm. you know, this is a service that women must be kind and useful vessels for, you know, men and women who come along and want to use their bodies. And then I think about the boys and how that appears to them. Mm-hmm. I think it's just quite an interesting psychological, almost like a phenomenon that you could look into and review and study and see what the, whether there was an impact or whether it meant nothing at all. I really don't know. But I mean, certainly to see essentially your siblings, I mean, you don't really know as a child if they're related to you or not. You think that the baby in your mother is a sibling of yours, as you've seen friends of yours, their mothers have children. And yeah, for that baby not to come home after the birth. And then of course the dangers, you know, essentially if your mother is ill or she's, you know, she's struggling at the end of the pregnancy, maybe she's got lots of morning sickness and can't play with you, and then she goes to hospital, maybe she's there for a long time, maybe she can't play with you so well when she's recovering from C-section. There's just so much, I think, the impact on children hasn't been considered or really explored.
Right. Well, or what we've just uncovered, or not uncovered, but it's just been brought to our attention, of 2 more U.S. surrogate mothers who have passed away during childbirth. And so in the worst case scenario, these mothers not coming back home to their little ones, you know, after going to
the... Doesn't bear thinking about the children and the partners who are left behind. It doesn't bear thinking about. And I was going to mention, because this is a really important area of study that I think is neglected. And we have something in the UK called Embrace, which is essentially, it's like the national records for maternal death. I know that's not something that you have in the US. And surrogacy isn't necessarily recorded by that. I think they need to start thinking about how that's done. But we do have records of, for example, like IVF. So if, you know, pregnancy, live births through egg donation, for example, would be measured by fertility clinics, and that gets recorded in some way. But I think, yeah, we need to look at the biological, medical risks that are specific to surrogacy pregnancies. And we need to measure them globally where we can. And we need to really look into common themes. You know, if there's placenta previa or placenta excreta, you know, all these kinds of conditions that you can have in pregnancy, but specifically measuring them for surrogacy pregnancies, because I think then if we had real statistics and we had real facts, women would obviously be able to make a more informed decision.
Right.
But then if they were to be put off or feel that there were risks, I mean, I'm aware of the possibly not the most recent death of a surrogate mother, but the one where you had Jennifer Lyle interview the widowed husband. Mm-hmm. And it's just utterly heartbreaking. It's just so difficult to even imagine.
Right. Right. It's a really heartbreaking interview, and it's on YouTube for anyone who wants to watch it. It just went out last week. And I'm grateful that there are men and family members who are willing to talk to us, because I do think it's so important that women understand, because you're right there. I could get on a soapbox all day about lack of research. I used to do research in a former life before I was a nurse. And I think, you know, for a world where we're so into following the science and knowing what science says, women's health, especially in artificial reproductive technologies, is severely lacking. And it from egg donation to egg freezing to surrogacy, we're just not doing women. We're not doing right by
yeah, women. And I think we should be looking at the connections between IVF and the menopause and, you know, essentially what happens if you've been on IVF drugs, you know, if you're on drugs to stimulate your ovaries and what that then does to your body later in life. I think, you know, there's lots of, you know, women who've done multiple surrogacies as well. Like, at what point do we say, you know, that's enough, you actually can't do this anymore? So one of the issues that we have with the proposals is that there's no limits. There's no age limits for either commissioning parents or surrogate mothers. There's only the proposal that they would be over 18. But even in one of the reports that I read that was sort of later on, there was a mention, and they weren't necessarily suggesting this, but there was a mention of, like, you know, could 16-year-olds be surrogate mothers? And you just think, no, they can't. And I just find it really bizarre that somebody would even mention that. Yeah, I mean, that's just a really ridiculous suggestion. And anyone saying that, you know, stating that in one of these evidence sessions is, I'm very concerned about why they would have that position or even that question or that suggestion. But if we're talking about 18-year-olds, you know, and also young commissioning parents or older commissioning parents, there would be no, you wouldn't have to have had a pregnancy and a labor before participating in surrogacy. You also wouldn't have, you know, like, you could have 10 pregnancies or 10 labors. Like, there's no limits applied. So it's almost like it's a free for all and everyone can kind of just do what they like. But mm-hmm. The one thing that we had up until, I think it never necessarily changed legally, but certainly agencies would really always say that you had to have had a pregnancy, right, and have completed your family. But I have noticed on surrogacy agencies here, like the kind of like the biggest agencies or the most established agencies, they do say that you don't need to be a mother already. So we are talking about a woman giving up her first baby. And if we're talking about 18-year-olds doing it, we're talking about 18-year-old girls potentially getting pregnant using their own egg and giving up a baby with no informed consent, right? Because they haven't been pregnant before. They've never had a baby before. They don't know what it feels like. They don't know about hormones. They don't know about that connection, that bonding. They're certainly told not to bond and that they can't bond or shouldn't bond. And, you know, through the sort of like the psychology of it, the language again.
Right. And right. It's very dissociative.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very divisive. And I think when you talk about, so with the language that I see in media articles and, you know, in the proposals, it's very much focused on the commissioning parents. Mm-hmm. It's very focused on their needs, their desires, you know, they want a baby, everyone has a right to a child, you know, all of this. And the surrogate mother is very much like, as long as she's, you know, willingly doing this and, you know, she's not being exploited, then it's all fine. But I think, right, you know, you have to look at what choice is and whether that's exploitation. If they say they're happy essentially to be exploited or to do it for money, to do it to get their bills covered. And, you know, when you look at vulnerable women, I mean, there was a BBC program that I think you could probably still see if you have BBC iPlayer. It's called The Surrogates. So straight away, mother is removed from the title. Mm. But there was a young woman there. I think she was 26. She had a son. Her name was Emma, and she had a baby for a gay couple, and it was her own egg. And she met them on an app, so she didn't go through an agency. And she, her story kind of struck me because, you know, they're kind of talking about it in really sort of surface level terms. But then later on in the program, she says that she had suicidal thoughts as a single mother. You know, she struggled, and she's living in a one bedroom apartment or one room apartment. You know, she sleeps on the sofa. And so for her, she says it healed her. And, you know, she has money. She was sort of like being looked after by these two guys, and she had friendship with them and, you know, some almost like an extended family. And that's great. And that could last a lifetime. Honestly, that could last a lifetime. But equally, as I know from other stories, it absolutely doesn't. And they get the child, and they might, you know, you might be around for the first year, or maybe not even that. They might drop you instantly. But it's this idea that in the UK, it's built on trust, it's built on friendship. And I'm just not convinced by that at all. I mean, the first surrogacy, the reason why we have the 1985 Surrogacy Act is because there's a woman called Kim Cotton. Now, she now runs COTS, which is one of the long established, one of the largest surrogacy agencies. Ultimately, there aren't that many here. We, you know, surrogacy in the UK isn't like a kind of like hugely widespread thing. But she sold a child. I mean, she did it for money, and it's kind of like quite well known. She's talked about the regret. She didn't know the parents. She didn't know the child's name. And sometimes she doesn't kind of refer to it. She then refers to a later surrogacy pregnancy where she had for a friend. And it's quite interesting because it's almost like she's kind of blocked it out in her own mind. But it was that action that she took. I think she did it through an American agency, actually. And then we obviously had the 1985 Surrogacy Act. So it kind of was like, this is not something that we're going to do in the UK. We're not going to have a commercial surrogacy. Mm-hmm. So that's where it started, really.
Gotcha. And people from the UK, can they, for our audience listening, can they go to the United States and can commissioning parents travel internationally? And are those kids recognized as citizens of the UK?
I think it's complicated. I imagine that it depends on the birth certificate that's issued in the country, wherever you're going to. But certainly, yes. I mean, you do have commissioning couples go abroad. Some prefer it because you don't have to have a relationship. I mean, I don't think you really have to have one enduring for life anyway, but certainly you have to kind of have some kind of a relationship if you go through a surrogacy agency. There was a court case fairly recently, maybe just a couple of years ago. There was a woman, she's referred to by X, and she had a medical negligence case in the UK with the NHS. And she received a level of compensation, but then she went back to court because ultimately, you know, she wouldn't be able to have children of her, you know, naturally. So she would need surrogacy. And the further payment that was awarded to her entitled her to go, you know, was enough money for her to go abroad. And the intention was for her to go to America to have up to four surrogate children, because she said that she wanted a large family. And she didn't want to have to be friends with the surrogate mother, and she wanted to have commercial surrogacy. So that was the ruling and the further financial agreement that was made by Lady Hale, which is it's a court case that people could look up if they wanted to. Yeah.
You talk here briefly a minute ago about people having a right to have a family or a right to a child, and we hear that often when we talk about surrogacy. So what's your rebuttal to that when people say, well, I have a right to have a child, or I have a right to have a family, and this is how I want to do it?
Yeah, I think ultimately people need to understand what human rights are and where you have them. And you can absolutely have, you know, the UN, you can have the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, for example, where they have, you know, a right to an identity and a right to know their biological parents and things like that. And you can have all of these things, but they're not enforced. So we can say, look, everyone has a right to life. Everyone has a right to clean water. Everyone has a right to food. I mean, years ago, I was involved in a charity that talked about a right to play, which ultimately was about children not having to become parents to their younger siblings due to being orphaned. And yes, wouldn't it be great if every child had a right to play and didn't have the responsibilities of essentially being a, you know, in a sense, a surrogate parent in lieu of having other parents, but we just don't have that. So I think having a right to a child is quite a dangerous claim to make. I think people should be quite clear about what they mean by that. And I think they should look at cases where people did have surrogate children given to them and they probably shouldn't have had any access to children. And I think that if we talk about it as a right, then I think we have to recognize that the child is a human being. Mm-hmm. And you don't have a right to purchase a child, and no one has a right to, quite frankly, even ask a woman to do this for you. In the UK, we do have it on an offering system. So, you know, in terms of the matching within agencies, it's the surrogate mother who chooses the pair, the people that she wants to work with, the couple, or even the single person. Obviously, they don't have to be in a couple. And I think, you know, there's that sort of framework, but then people are, like I say, operating outside of that. And you can, of course, do it within families. You can do it within friendships. Yeah, I think there's another thing I'd like to mention in connection with the right to a family. We have the Yogacarta principles, which aren't ratified. And I think in there, it's the right to found a family, which can be misinterpreted to mean a right to a family or a right to a child, which isn't quite the same thing. And also they're not recognised in UK law, the Yogacarta principles, I mean. But then there's also something that's kind of coming up into the language, which is, well, there's two things. It's fertility equality and reproductive rights mm-hmm. for all. And surrogacy as a fertility treatment, which I think they're two phrases that are, again, quite dangerous, or like you're going to have to explore that and look at what that means. So surrogacy as a medical fertility treatment is obviously not, it's not what it is. Right. So, you know, if you're using a woman's body to have a baby on your behalf, is that woman then, you know, she's kind of like a medical method or pathway, you know, whatever it is for you to get what you to meet your dreams and your deepest desires. Mm-hmm. And the fertility equality, obviously, that, you know, when it sort of goes along with reproductive rights for all, you know, we have reproductive rights when we talk about abortion and about women having the right to choose and things like that. And then, you know, it's almost like the language is being molded again to mean reproductive access to reproductive rights. And you know, if you're a single man or two men in a gay relationship, you know, you have like fertility equality, and then like it's just really unfortunate that they biologically can't reproduce on their own and they have to have rights and access to a woman's body in order to do that. And I think there's that, again, it's again about the language and these terms that are being formed, and you know, talking about family building, you know, these things that kind of come through and you think, you know, where is this coming from and who is coming up with these terms and where does it lead us? I think we need to think a bit more deeply about it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the reproductive rights movement or idea, in essence, though, it breaks down because then you are destroying the rights of the woman that you are hiring, right? Because then you are saying mm-hmm. you must do, especially in cases like India, the severe cases where you must live in this house that we tell you to live in. You must stay away from your family. You must listen to this type of music. You must abort the fetus if I tell you to. And
yeah,
so
sure.
we're saying, you know.
But it curtails your freedoms. We're talking about women having rights and women mm-hmm. being human beings and therefore having human rights and having access to quality healthcare. And like we say, like studies and research into, you know, our biology that's specifically about us and affects us in different ways. And then we're saying, if you're doing this, if you're engaged in surrogacy, then actually it gets to a point where, for me, it's like you're owning somebody. Yeah. You own the baby. Like they always say, the baby doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the commissioning parents because of the genetic material. So it's like you're owning something that's inside somebody else. If you think of like Russian dolls and you think about the tiniest doll in the middle and it's, you know, it was the egg from your great grandmother and it comes down the, you know, down the family line. And then it's just quite an odd concept to me that you would own something that is inside somebody else. And there was an interesting case in New Zealand, I think it was, where I was reading about this, where, you know, ultimately the surrogate mother just decided that she couldn't continue with the pregnancy. The commissioning mother was very much like, you know, but this is my baby, this is my DNA, you don't have a right to abort this pregnancy because I, you know, it's mine, you don't get to decide. And, you know, the law reform that is coming up in New Zealand, and there were some sort of like some quotes from some politicians there. And it was almost like, well, we can force her to give birth. You know, if this isn't her genetic material, we can force her to give birth and give the baby over. And it was very, yeah, it was just, I kind of thought like, how have we got to this place? Like, yeah, this is a really bizarre way to talk about women and to talk about reproductive rights that are, we're not talking about the women giving birth, we're talking about the woman that's who owns the DNA, and right, we're talking about it in different terms, and everything's kind of shifting and language is shifting. And yeah, you just sometimes you wonder how we ended up here and then where is it going to go next.
Yeah, well, I'm hopeful that because of these things are starting to come to, it seems like we've definitely put the cart in front of the horse when it comes to, yeah, some of these reproductive technologies. And I'm hoping, and the point of this Venus Rising is so that people can actually start thinking critically about this. And maybe we can start saying, and organizations like yours, like, wait a second, these laws, like, let's think about this. Let's give this another.
That's exactly what we want to do. I mean, we want to basically just have a rethink about this particular law that's being proposed to reform. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that it will go ahead to some degree. It's a matter of what it includes and what it excludes. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like the lobbying and the way that it came about, I think that's quite concerning. And I think they kind of need to take it back a notch and say, okay, let's look at this again. Or if we are going to come up with a draft bill soon and we're going to see what the content is and what the proposals are, that we most certainly consider some age limits and some quite basic safeguarding around this, essentially, and have this consideration about the baby being the, you know, the sort of genetic property and the, you know, you get legal parental rights at birth. I mean, some of the stuff that obviously I've read from coming out of the US, you know, in different states, I understand there's no sort of like federal law, but, you know, they're pre-birth orders and then contracts that are obviously commercial contracts. They specify, you know, breast milk pumping afterwards, you know, the diet, you can get paid more money if you follow a particular diet or for how many days. I understand that some contracts have like no sex clauses, no, yep, kissing clauses, mm-hmm, and that there's like a complete control of this woman's life. You know, I wonder how they know about some of this stuff. I mean, how do they know that these women don't have sex with their husbands or their partners? I mean, they've got, yeah, spy cameras. I don't know. I mean, it probably wouldn't surprise me. But there's a lot of this that's almost like it's a very insidious, persuasive thing where the woman literally gives up her body and her life. And she says, yes, you control me. This is, I welcome this. I give permission for this to happen. And I know Renata Klein has said something like, you know, this isn't going to stop until women stop sort of offering themselves up. And I think, you know, we can't end it. You know, we're called Stop Surrogacy Now. We're certainly looking to stop the law reform and looking to make it more focused and involve like a broader range of voices and not just have one, you know, surrogacy agencies and lobby groups speaking to lawmakers about this. But we have to look at the sort of like the broader context of surrogacy and where, what this even means if we say mothers don't exist, or, you know, a mother is somebody who's on a birth certificate, or a mother is somebody, you know, everyone who's adopted has a birth mother somewhere for some reason or another. They were adopted, and there's a whole range of reasons why that can happen. But we have genealogical bewilderment in children who are adopted, in children and adults who have adopted, and we know this happens. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything solid on surrogacy to see what happens to these children when they grow up, And, you know, we know certainly a bit about if they've been donor conceived. You know, there's obviously the Donor Conceived Network, and there's some great work being done there to sort of like raise awareness of what actually it means to be donor conceived. But since we've had all this technology, you know, just because we can doesn't mean we should. Right. And we've been doing this for decades now. And I really think there's got to be a moment in time where we just pause and say, actually, are we going down the right track here? Is there something that we want to correct or shift or just have a think about? And I'm hoping very much that obviously the law reform, the progress with this particular bill, when it comes up, that there's something that can be done in that respect. We just have to try our best.
Yeah. So what can people who are located in the United Kingdom do to support or help you? And what can people around the globe do to support and help you?
I mean, certainly when it comes to reform, there will be some actions on our website when we get a bit closer. We will look at the draft bill and obviously look to see what it contains. We would ask people to, so people who are based in the UK, to write to their MPs, write to their parliamentarians, their politicians to say, you know, what their concerns are, whether they would have some, you know, they would want to have a conversation with them. There's something that MPs do in the UK is that they have surgeries. They basically have like meetings with their constituents and you can go and meet with them. But certainly you could definitely write to them. All emails for MPs are available on the government website. You can definitely find the person and write to them. I think in terms of support globally, I would say that actually you should look at your own laws. I mean, I would say particularly for sort of like Australia, New Zealand, in Ireland, I think we'll probably follow something, whatever happens in the UK. In Europe, people, you know, the laws are pretty set. I mean, this is what I think marks the UK as being quite different, is that actually across Europe, it's pretty much banned. If it's not banned, you know, there's definitely lots of restrictions. It's very highly regulated. So I think to look at your own laws, and if there's a way that you can support us, it would just be to sort of like share us, join our social media. We're on Twitter at it's at Wombs for Rent, and look at our website, follow our blog, and there will be actions on the website that people can take. It would mostly be led by UK residents, but people can obviously follow us and see what we're doing and raise awareness on the issues around the exploitation of women, the commodification of their bodies, and how, you know, if this is happening in your country where you are, or in your state, you know, to obviously understand what the laws are and whether that's something that anyone wants to contest.
Mm-hmm. And I will include that handle and how they can contact you in the little blurb to this, but then I'll also say it at the end too. But I do believe it, your handle's Wombs Not For Rent, correct?
Not For Rent. That's right. So we had a struggle getting that handle, I think, because there was like loads of other things that. So we're quite new to social media. I mean, we're a newly formed campaign. We've not been going for very long. And it's very much grassroots, as you said at the beginning. You know, they were just sort of like concerned mums, essentially. I mean, this is kind of like how we met. And we think this is kind of something that needs looking at. There's a lot of grassroots campaigning happening in the UK, particularly around self-ID, around the Gender Recognition Act, you know, around education. It's really strong. I think there's a lot of really fantastic work going on in the UK, and there's other issues that are very much the focus. Mm-hmm. And so surrogacy, because it actually isn't, you know, the numbers have changed. There are way more parental orders now than, I think it's quadrupled in about 10 years. This is another thing that research from Kent University sort of like brought up. But this is very, it's not, you know, commercial, it's not kind of in the same shape as in the States. But we have the National Health Service, and I think we have fantastic maternity care, like high quality care. We have great maternity rights, you know, obviously with maternity leave. There's also something called the maternity allowance if you're not working. And it's a great draw, actually, the UK for essentially surrogacy tourism. And I think, you know, as we sort of like raise awareness around this, it's like, well, this is, we're kind of marked out as being a bit different in Europe. So what would happen if we do relax the laws, if we do make it more accessible to people? You know, we need a sort of feasibility study on whether the NHS would be burdened by it in terms of the care. There'd be safeguarding issues. They would have to sort of decide what to do with releasing the baby and, you know, the care of the mother. It's very complex. And I think people need to think about it a bit more. Mm-hmm. As a broader spectrum of what it could impact on.
Well, Lexi, I think our time is coming to an end, and it's been a privilege to have you on the show and to talk to you more in detail about what's going on in the UK. So thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with me.
Absolutely. Thank you again for having me. It's lovely.
Of course. For our listeners and viewers, you can find Stop Surrogacy Now UK on Twitter with the handle at Wombs Not For Rent. And you can find more about Lexi and her organization by going to StopSurrogacyNowUK.org. You can join the global movement by visiting StopSurrogacyNow.com. And there's a petition there for you to sign if you're interested. I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in. Our goal, as ever, is always to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you all to think beyond the masses. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.